loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by Walter Smolarek and Nicole Rossell, who are both sitting in for John Kiriakou, who's traveling this week. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, we look at some of the biggest news of the week, including the Democratic National Committee announcement today that they are suing WikiLeaks, the 2016 Trump election campaign, and the government of Russia. Meanwhile, the so-called Comey memos are out, and Andrew McCabe's case has been referred by the Inspector General of the Department of Justice for possible criminal prosecution. And then in our second segment, we continue to look at the 2018 midterm elections and, in particular, the political and social issues that are riveting the country. We continue our coverage with the Lookman Nation.
But before we get to those two stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, all around the world, whistleblowers who expose the misdeeds of the rich and powerful are persecuted, but many countries have also adopted legislation to offer them some form of protection. Loud and Clear co-host John Kiriakou has been in Greece this week to address the Greek parliament and meet senior government officials as that country prepares to pass its first true whistleblower protection law. Next, the Department of Health and Human Services is reportedly planning to issue regulations that will further restrict undocumented people's ability to access healthcare. We'll take an in-depth look today and tomorrow at this latest attack on immigrants and the barriers to healthcare access that already existed. Then, we've all heard about GMOs or genetically modified foods, but new research has created what's being called GMO 0.2 or gene-edited food. What is this new creation, and is it any safer than GMO 0.1? And then, the U.S. and the U.K. took the highly unusual step of issuing a joint technical alert this week, which says that Russia has hacked millions of personal and home technological devices. Is this true? What's the big picture? And finally, it's Friday, time for our regular look at the worst and most misleading headlines of the week. And in other headlines, at least four Palestinians have been killed, including a 15-year-old boy, by Israeli forces in yet another mass shooting of unarmed demonstrators along the border of the besieged Gaza Strip. Well over 645 have been wounded in today's march. The Palestinian protesters were participating in the Great March of Return, a series of actions that began on March 30th. In total, at least 39 Palestinians have been killed, and over 4,000 wounded, many by live ammunition. Banking giant Wells Fargo was hit with a $1 billion fine today. The fine was imposed by the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency and the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Regulators levied the penalties on Wells Fargo in response to the bank's practice of misleading consumers into purchasing auto insurance and paying unnecessary fees on mortgages. Rudy Giuliani has been added to Donald Trump's personal legal team as the Mueller investigation heats up. Giuliani is a former federal prosecutor and mayor of New York, known for his extreme so-called tough-on-crime policies, who also ran for president in 2008. Giuliani was an earlier supporter of Trump's presidential campaign, who at one point was rumored to be on Trump's shortlist for Secretary of State. Civil rights prosecutors have recommended that charges be filed against New York police officer Daniel Pantaleo for the murder of Eric Garner, a black father whose killing sparked huge protests across the country. It is unclear if the Department of Justice will act on that recommendation. Attorney General Jeff Sessions has long been accused of racism, something that derailed his confirmation hearing for a federal judgeship during the Reagan administration. Those are today's headlines. Next up is a discussion about the lawsuit filed by the DNC against Russia, WikiLeaks, and Trump, along with other big news of the week.
Loud and clear.
But first, we're going to turn to the big stories of the week. It's Friday, and it's been a big week of news this week. Just today, the Democratic National Committee announced they're suing Donald Trump, WikiLeaks, and Russia. Memos were also released from James Comey that depict interactions with Donald Trump, and the Inspector General's report on McCabe has been sent to the U.S. Attorney for potential criminal charges. We're joined from Pittsburgh by Dan Kovalik. He's a human rights and labor lawyer who is the author of The Plot to Scapegoat Russia. And from New York by Jim Cavanaugh. He is the editor of the polemicist Net. Dan Kovalik and Jim, welcome back.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Well, let's get started. The Democratic National Committee today filed a multi-million-dollar lawsuit against the Russian government, the Trump campaign, and the WikiLeaks organization, alleging a far-reaching conspiracy to disrupt the 2016 campaign and tilt the election to Donald Trump. Jim Kavanaugh, that's kind of a surprise development. I mean, here we are in the midst of the Robert Mueller probe. Why did the DNC do this?
I'm not sure. Maybe they think the Robert Mueller probe has not found enough evidence of Russian collusion and may not. So they're going to try and keep that story alive through this lawsuit. But this really represents to me a further example of the shifting, the replacement of politics with legal and prosecutorial actions. In other words, the things they can't win politically, they try to compensate for with prosecutions, and legal suits, lawsuits, litigation. That's designed to just keep their story going and to prevent their opponents from ever being able to get out of the shadow of these lawsuits. It's really quite bizarre, and it's a flight from politics, really. It's a flight from politics to litigation, and I think it's just crazy.
Dan Kovalik, I'm going to read to you a few sentences from a Democratic National Committee chairperson Tom Perez about this lawsuit. Quote, during the 2016 presidential campaign, Russia launched an all-out assault on our democracy, and it found a willing and active partner in Donald Trump's campaign. This constituted an act of unprecedented treachery. The campaign of a nominee for president of the United States in league with a hostile foreign power to bolster its own chance to win the presidency. The complaint, that's the end of the Tom Perez quote, but the complaint filed in the federal district court in Manhattan charges that top Trump campaign officials conspired with the Russian government and its military spy agency to hurt Democratic presidential nominee Hillary Clinton. And it helped Trump by hacking the computer networks of the Democratic Party and disseminating stolen material. Dan Kovalik, your reaction?
There's so many parts to those allegations that are wrong, it's hard to know where to start. I mean, I'd like to start with the first, you know, premise, which is that Russia is allegedly a hostile power, which I don't see that to be the case. They've been, you know, fighting on the same side as the U.S. in the war on terror, for example, for a long time, and I don't see the hostile force. But, of course, that is the key premise here, because if it were France or Britain or Canada that Trump allegedly conspired with, obviously that would be a non-story. But meanwhile, as has already been pointed out, there's been no evidence of collusion that the FBI has found, even after these many, many months of investigation. So I see nothing here of substance in these allegations. I also find it interesting and maybe telling that this lawsuit was filed very shortly after new polls have come out showing that, in fact, the Democrats are, you know, at least at the moment, poised to do not as well in the 2018 congressional elections as they had hoped. And so this seems to me to be a kind of a desperate move on the Democrats' part, the Democrats lacking in policy to try to regain some of their advantage for the 2018 election.
So I want to, Dan is an attorney, and Jim, I know you're paying careful attention, so I want to ask a couple questions related to the process here. The civil suit filed by the Democratic National Committee against WikiLeaks, the Trump campaign of 2016, and the Russian government, that will go forward if the district court allows it to go forward. Undoubtedly, there will be a motion to dismiss this lawsuit as a frivolous lawsuit or on other bases.
From whom?
Well, that's what I'm getting at, because the Russian government won't obviously intervene and allow a U.S. district court to have jurisdiction over Russia. So I doubt very much. I mean, I don't know, but I would doubt that Russia will participate. WikiLeaks could enter an appearance in court and ask for a summary judgment, or the Trump 2016 election campaign could do so. But if there's not, if the case is not thrown out, then it goes forward. We have instances where, many actually, where the government of Syria or the government of Iran or previously the Palestine Liberation Organization were brought in civil actions before U.S. district courts. And because they don't authorize those courts to have jurisdiction over their sovereign existence, they don't go into court, they don't defend against it, and thus the court then awards penalties, allowing asset seizures to take place. Again, not because Iran or Syria or the PLO, or in this case, if Russia follows the same path, are necessarily admitting guilt. They're just not going to go into an American court and let an American judge decide their fate. Is something like that possible?
I think it's quite possible. It's almost inevitable. For Russia, certainly. I think you're right, WikiLeaks and the Trump campaign may intervene here. But there's another aspect of this which is kind of interesting, that if this suit goes forward, people are going to have to produce evidence. People are going to have to make statements under oath. Who are they going to get to do that? Call Julian Assange and ask him? Call people in, who's Craig Murray in, who says, I know the guy who gave me these emails and it wasn't the DNC? That'll be interesting. But as you said, I think this is a big theater and it's a campaign tactic. But it could hurt. They will take assets from Russia and WikiLeaks.
And then, of course, if the court case goes forward, a discovery can happen in both directions. I mean, it would be actually interesting to find out from the Democratic National Committee. I'm not suggesting that there's a silver lining here, but the Democratic National Committee never provided the FBI with the server which CrowdStrike, the private security agency that the DNC employed, said that the Russians hacked the DNC. The Russians have denied it. Other people assert that it wasn't a hack at all, that it was a leak. We don't know. And the FBI doesn't actually know either, because not only was the FBI denied by the Democratic National Committee the right to inspect that server to do a forensic investigation, the FBI under James Comey never subpoenaed that server. Would that then make the Democratic National Committee available for discovery by, say, the Trump campaign? Why did you not deliver the server to the FBI for a forensic investigation? Anyway, Dan, what's your view on that?
Yeah, well, of course, anytime you bring a lawsuit against someone else, you know, you open yourself up to discovery. And so that certainly is a risk that the DNC is taking here. Though, again, I'm not sure the case is going to go very far. You have these sovereign immunity issues that you touched upon. Russia has sovereign immunity, which is going to be hard to get around. And by the way, Russia could enter a limited appearance just to make challenges on that without conceding, you know, jurisdiction. That could happen if they wanted to do that. And with WikiLeaks, you know, who is WikiLeaks? You know, and that's an interesting kind of question. And does the court have personal jurisdiction over WikiLeaks? Those would be big questions. The other thing a judge could do, frankly, is just say, look, I'm going to hold this case in abeyance to see what the FBI comes up with. You know, why should we go through all this work with discovery and counter-discovery when the FBI, which has greater investigatory power, is actively investigating this? So I don't think this is going to go very far. This is a publicity stunt, and we'll see how much this gets the DNC. Again, I would think that they'd be better off talking about things like health care and fixing roads and dealing with poverty issues, but obviously they've decided this is the way they want to go.
I think this is a losing strategy. I mean, they're supporting Trump as long as he's bombing another country, something, you know, that's not that exciting or even supported by people in the United States, especially people are not going to be energized to go to the polls about that. I don't think they're going to be energized to go to the polls about this. And also, I think the guests are right, Walter. There seems to be a sort of a turning of the tide a little bit. Even though Trump is so unpopular, the Democrats are also very, very unpopular, and this just isn't going to resonate.
Yeah, and people are disaffected with, you know, the traditional, like, Democrat or Republican electoral politics in general. I mean, I think that's the primary reason why Donald Trump won, and not necessarily because there's a big surge of support for Donald Trump, but because there are a lot of people who just decided to to stay home. Dan, I wanted to ask you a follow-up question because I know that you're also following issues in Latin America very closely and the fight for sovereignty of those countries that have been traditionally considered the quote-unquote backyard of the United States. Argentina was also sued in U.S. courts and waged a very protracted legal battle against Paul Singer, who is a major political donor in the United States and a hedge fund billionaire. Or at least multi-millionaire. Argentina did choose to defend itself in that circumstance. Can you talk a little bit about that experience, if it has any precedent, any bearing on what Russia may be thinking about?
Yes. Well, as you say, Argentina did defend itself in that case because they, wanted to avoid huge liability, and they ended up losing a lot of that case. But that's not the only case where that has happened. Cuba appeared in one of those famous international law cases in the early 1960s in a Supreme Court case where they won, where exiled Cubans and U.S. companies were trying to regain property that Fidel had nationalized during the revolution. And the Supreme Court ruled in Cuba's favor in something called the active state doctrine, saying that you could not challenge an act of a sovereign state in U.S. courts. And so there's a lot of precedence of countries defending themselves in U.S. courts. And again, maybe Russia would look at those and decide to defend themselves, at least in a limited capacity, in the United States courts.
I also want to turn, Jim Kavanaugh, this is an interesting lawsuit because the United States, by the admission of many now within the summits of the U.S. political and media establishment, the U.S. has a very, very long history of meddling in other countries' elections. Can we see other countries perhaps taking out civil lawsuits within their own court system, getting judgments against the United States for interfering in their elections, say in Guatemala, say in Iran, say in Russia? Because, of course, the U.S. interfered very, dramatically in the 1996 election for Boris Yeltsin and rescued the Yeltsin candidacy. Could other countries follow suit and do the same thing and then start to, try to put a lien or seize assets of the U.S. based on damages in their own sovereign courts?
In principle, why not? That's why there are these principles of state sovereignty, and that you can't expect a sovereign state to be brought into the civil courts of another country. Sure, why not? I mean, I don't think they'll do it because they're not, they might and they should, but they're not just, this is kind of, again, this is a silly way of substituting litigation for politics. And they have a political problem with Russia, have a political problem with Trump. Fight that political problem. Get the political support for it. As Dan said, there are issues here. There are issues of health care and of war and peace. And if you look at my Twitter line, I've seen some people who are MAGA people coming on saying after the Syria strike, this is it. Trump is proving he's just another globalist warmonger. There's a lot of opening here politically. But this attitude that we're going to file a lawsuit against Russia and WikiLeaks, the demons that we can't even know touch anyway, is just nuts. So yes, it could happen, and it should happen. Why shouldn't they do it? I just don't know if they're going to be that interested in doing it because they're not playing the same silly political games.
Yeah, let's talk about a couple of the other issues because time is going fast here. Dan Kovalik and Jim, the Comey memos are out. They're readable now. I don't know if you've taken a look. Some of the stuff is fairly interesting about his own interactions with Donald Trump. Of course, this is a one-sided memorializing of meetings. In other words, it's not what Trump says. It's what Comey says about the meetings. Dan, when you read it, any takeaways?
One of the interesting takeaways is that, the narrative has been generally that the claim is that Trump wanted to shut down the FBI investigation of things like the dossier, which contains some of the more salacious sexual allegations here. But the Comey memos show that, in fact, Trump wanted them investigated to try to debunk them. So that's kind of an interesting twist here, which I think many of us did not expect.
Jim, how about you?
Well, I didn't see anything particularly new. I mean, clearly Trump doesn't like the stories of the prostitutes. Who would? And this is really repeating things that I think we've all heard before. We get to see that in Comey's own language in the memos. And, you know, Comey's a guy who's been very good at presenting himself as a righteous character. And this is a self-justifying set of memos that doesn't add anything new for me about this. So I don't know, you know, it's this stripper story and the Steele dossier and the hookers, and, you know, it's all salacious silliness as far as I'm concerned. You know, Stormy Daniels and Trump's fascination with hookers is replacing politics again.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you on that. But I thought what was interesting was what Dan was saying. I want to read a couple sentences from the Comey memo for the audience, because not because the issue is important, but because the narrative of this entire thing even appears to be completely twisted. Again, Trump wanted Comey to investigate some of the main findings of the Steele dossier, that famous dossier, so that by virtue of an FBI investigation, it could be proven to be untrue. And I'm going to read it. Here's Comey's memo. At about that point, he turned to what he called, quote, the golden showers thing, close quote, and recounted much of what he had said previously on that topic. He repeated that it was a complete fabrication and fake news. I explained again why I thought it was important that he know about it. I also explained that one of the reasons we told him was that the media, CNN in particular, was telling us that they were about to run with it. He said it bothered him if his wife thought there was even 1% chance it was true in any respect. He said he had spoken to people who had been on the Miss Universe trip with him, and they had reminded him that he didn't stay overnight in Russia for that. He said he arrived in the morning, did events, then showered and dressed for the pageant at the hotel. He didn't say the hotel name, and he left for the pageant. Afterwards, he returned only to get his things because they departed for New York by plane that night. He said he thought maybe he should ask me to investigate the whole thing to prove it was a lie. Now, then Comey sort of basically keeps telling him, no, that's not a good idea. We don't want to investigate. And Trump says, okay, well, maybe you're right, but maybe you should investigate. And Comey says, no, I don't think so. I mean, I think the point isn't the issue itself. The point is that the whole presentation was that Comey was fired because he was going to vigorously investigate stories like this, and Trump wanted to stop him. But in fact, at least in this very important, because it was a big important part of the media presentation, it was just the opposite. Anyway, Dan, let's just finish up with you on this, and then I want to get to Andrew McCabe.
Yeah, well, I think this underscores another point that some of us have been saying for a long time, and that is that this smells of the fact that, you know, while the FBI was claiming it was telling Trump of these allegations because, for example, they claimed, oh, so that, you know, you might know that Russia may want to blackmail you. In fact, it seems like they told him because they were blackmailing him, because the FBI wanted to prevent him from a detente with Russia. So they were kind of telling him that we have this information on you that we could use against you, you know. And when you look at the memos, again, to me, there is a scent of that in there, that the FBI was the one using this information to hold over Trump's head, not the Russians.
Yeah. Let's, Jim Kavanaugh, I agree with you. I think you really have the sense of it, because Comey clears the room to tell Trump about this memo and all the salacious details. And then when Trump says, yeah, please investigate it to prove that it's not true, Comey says, we don't need to do that. Anyway, let's turn... Go ahead, Jim.
I'm going to say also in Comey's memo, he says when Trump asks him about that to investigate the Golden Showers thing, Comey says, I repeated what I had told the president about not wanting to create a narrative that we were investigating him. Suddenly, Comey is putting himself in a position of saying, not that we should investigate this, but that I'm not going to investigate it because I don't want to make you look bad, which is a little strange, you know? The other times he's kept saying, well, I wasn't going to let the president stop me from investigating things that I should investigate. But when it came to this, I don't want you to look bad. So that's not why I'm not investigating.
I hear you on that. Let's turn in our final couple minutes to the referral by the Justice Department's Inspector General of Andrew McCabe, former deputy director. He was fired right before he was going to retire, thus ended his prospects, at least at that time, to get his pension. I think we're now learning that he's worth $17 million, so maybe he'll survive anyway. But Dan Kovalik, let's talk about this referral and also about Comey's attitude towards the referral.
Yeah, well, I mean, it looks like he's being referred because he himself leaked information to the press, or allegedly leaked information to the press, about the early days of the FBI's investigation into this alleged collusion with Russia. And, you know, again, it makes it McCabe look like hardly the disinterested investigator that he has claimed to be. And he looks quite partisan in some of this. And again, because he was trying to gin up press information against Trump during the campaign by leaking confidential investigations to the press. So that's a very interesting turn of events, and that he's actually been referred for possible criminal charges, I think, is a very interesting twist in all of this.
Well, we'll keep following that. Jim Kavanaugh, 1 minute left. We're going to give you the final word. Big picture here. Big picture is, again, perhaps past the point of no return in terms of a long-term hostility between the United States and Russia. I think Russia wanted better relations. That's not going to happen. We've entered a new phase in global politics. Go ahead.
Yes, they're not stopping with this. They're moving forward towards more and more aggression against Russia. What happened last week with the attack on Syria was extremely dangerous. And the way in which it ended up working out that they didn't do anything that would upset Russia or get Russia involved was fortuitous. And that deserves looking into. But I don't think they stopped with that. I think they're going to try again, and they're going to keep provoking. And as far as this stuff on the domestic front with these kinds of scenarios, we have a domestic political landscape now that is just almost beyond ridiculous. You can't get anybody even talking seriously about war with Russia, about Syria. You know, everybody's got to be on the same page. There's no room in the mainstream media to have a debate, a critical debate about that or about any of these other issues. It's not going to be about whether we have single-payer health care or whether we have war with Russia. It's going to be about what James Comey say in his memo about golden showers. And this is crazy.
Yeah, it is. And the big picture is what we just talked about. And the witch hunt is growing. We have an important progressive person in the South who's being demonized by National Public Radio because she was on this show and By Any Means Necessary, Eugene Puryear, Sean Blackman show. I mean, really ridiculous and, of course, dangerous. People have to stand up and resist the witch hunt. Anyway, we've been joined from Pittsburgh by Dan Kovalik. He's a human rights and labor lawyer. He's the author of The Plot to Scapegoat Russia, and from New York City by Jim Kavanaugh. He's the editor of thepolemicist.net. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a brief break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Today, we continue our regular update on the midterm elections and politics in the United States. The competition to be the next Speaker of the House and Senator from California has been intense, but on one thing, Congress seems to mostly agree, war against Syria. We're joined in studio by Jacqueline Lukman and Abdus Lukman. They're the co-editors-in-chief of Lukman Nation. Welcome back.
Thanks. Thanks for having us back.
Abdus, let's start with you. It's been, you know, an extremely eventful period in the world, in the United States, in the political arena. What's been on your radar this last week?
Well, what's been on our radar, of course, is Syria, as always. We also had the celebration of Israel's independence, which coincided with the Palestinian observance of what they call the Nakba, or the catastrophe, and the fact that now Iran is threatening some repercussions if the United States go ahead and pull out of the nuclear deal. So again, we're just seeing this whole the U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East is just basically just causing more and more of a mess over there.
Yeah. And it's interesting as we look at the midterm races, how little about this foreign policy that's so critical to where we are in this country politically. A lot of these candidates are talking that nobody's talking about. These issues in Syria and the connection with Iran and the trouble continuing to back a murderous and oppressive Israeli regime can actually cause Americans as far as domestic policy is concerned. And that's really dangerous and it's unfortunate.
Yeah, you know, the Congress people who I've seen, like the prominent leaders of the Democratic and Republican parties who put out statements in response to the airstrikes on Syria, they basically range from either like full support, like this is great, we had to stand up to the, you know, barbarian Assad or, you know, whatever. That I mean, that's truly the kind of language that they're using. Or they'd say, well, okay, so this is good, but basically it's not enough. You know, this isn't a complete strategy. You know, the Trump administration needs to come to Congress with like a real plan. I mean, essentially, like how I read that is, okay, well, you need to go further. You need to actually have like a regime change operation. Is that how you read that?
Yeah, that's how I'm reading it. And since we're talking about the midterms, Jack, and I like what you brought up about how even the candidates, those that are throwing their hat in the ring for the midterms, how Syria hasn't been a really big talking point, you know. And so I guess what really frustrates me the most with all of this is that we see that that nothing brings the Democrats and Republicans together more than bombing somewhere over there.
Right.
You
right.
know, so I guess as an anti-war activist myself, I'm a little bit reluctant to see any real change when it comes to U.S. Militarism in the even if the Democrats do have this wave that I expect them to have, you know, so I don't see much change there.
Yeah, it's very disheartening because we've got races in several states that the Republicans should be just, you know, walking away with that are actually much tighter than people thought they would be. And none of these Democratic candidates are pushing an anti-war agenda because basically they're hoping to cash in on war just like their predecessors have, especially in races like in, I think it's Illinois, where there's a huge pension crisis and there's been a Republican candidate who is just announced his candidacy to run against Rauner. And the reason he's getting support is because he has support from organized labor, which is unusual for a Republican candidate. But the pension crisis is so bad in Illinois that he's running on a platform of trying to fix the pension crisis. But when you're not tying the imperialist war machine and the money that it's gobbling up from services like public pensions, people don't make that connection and they don't understand how important imperialism is and the effect that it has on something like teachers' pension.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. I mean, there's a lot of issues that aren't being talked about in the election. So you have the Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, deciding that he's not going to run because the political situation is so dire, I guess, in the country. Or, you know, maybe he could just make a lot more money in the private sector. There are a lot of Republicans.
Or he thought he might lose, like which would, of course, be the end of his presidential ambitions, which is what he's really still harboring.
Right.
Yeah. And I think actually that's more likely. I think that's a more likely reason.
Noble causes or even money making aside, that would be the end of Ryan if he can't, as Speaker of the House, can't win his congressional seat, which it looked like he would win, but it wasn't a slam dunk, so to speak.
And it's a very right wing district too. I mean, it's very conservative. You know, like it's one of those districts that Republicans have traditionally looked at as being like completely safe. They don't have to spend any money there. I mean, they have this, you know, ultra prominent politician, an incumbent. But all of a sudden now they're worried about that election. They're also worried about some of the elections in the Philadelphia suburbs, some of the other suburbs and major cities. Philadelphia was also in the news because of the protests that had broken out after police removed two black men from a Starbucks. The cops were called like 3 minutes after the guys walked in there. That's another issue, you know, so war is not really on the agenda when the politicians campaign. Police brutality and racism is not really on the public agenda. I mean, it's kind of the campaign so far has been pretty vacuous. I mean, you know, like all the Trump scandals, there's a new one every week. But it's not necessarily what people, like ordinary people, are sitting down and thinking about every day.
No. And what really bothers me is all of that you just mentioned. And here the DNC is talking about filing the lawsuit, or they have filed a lawsuit, you know, suing Russia. And suing, who was it? It was suing. It was
WikiLeaks, yeah. and
the Trump Organization.
Yeah, yeah. So again, it's about Hillary not winning, you know, once again. And as you mentioned, all of the things that they can be addressed or could be addressing, that this, again, as Jackie and I were talking earlier today, again, we talk about political theater. We talk about how are you going to sue? What do you gain out of that? One of the things that I think that they're probably looking to gain from it is a look at the discovery. So if they sue, they have a look at the discovery and see what's going on there. But again, it's a waste of our time. I think it's a waste of their time.
Yeah, and I think it's another way for Democrats to bolster their pretty, like you said, vacuous campaign. And I think that's true on both sides of the aisle. The Republicans have an empty platform. Because Trump is such a horrible president. He is so unpopular, even among Republicans. And you have a lot of Republicans who don't have an answer for his horrible policies. They can't campaign on the tax plan because it's really, it's not doing what it was promised.
And Wayne, Bank of America's profits just went up 30% this quarter.
Right.
Well, it's not doing what it was promised for the voters.
The
donors, yes. It was a wonderful gift. But for the Democrats, their platform is nothing more than we're not Trump.
Yeah. And let's go back to the Syria issue, because, you know, the other thing that Trump started to be being criticized for was not getting congressional approval. Congress started to whine, meaning the Democrats, and say, we wanted to approve, but you didn't ask us, Donald. We wanted to say yes to bombing another country that the country was at peace with. In other words, an illegal act. Also, fairness and accuracy in media did a survey of the editorial pages on the Syria attack, on Trump's Syria attack. Now, these newspapers, the major newspapers, are very anti-Trump, as you said, until he bombed Syria. Here's some of the statistics about that. And the Democrats are part of the same political slash media establishment. Of the top 100 newspapers, 47 ran editorials on President Donald Trump's Syria airstrikes last week, 39 in favor, 7 ambiguous, and only one opposed the military attack. That was the Houston Chronicle. And they opposed it on constitutional grounds that he had not gotten approval. So they are all for it.
Right, mm-hmm. Right.
This includes the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, USA Today, Daily News, Washington Post, New York Post, Chicago Sun-Times, and Denver Post, all supporting President Trump as long as he's at war. And so, of course, the Democrats are also going to be supporting the same policies. That's why I want to talk about this. You know, every 2 years and every 4 years especially, the progressive anti-war, anti-racist left movement decides that one or another of the factions of the elites is a lesser danger than the other faction, and that we must then affix our wagon to them, because otherwise the sky will fall. And right now there's all this talk about blue wave. Is the blue wave going to replace the Republicans in the House of Representatives? What will that mean? Well, you know, the Syria attack gave us a taste of what it will mean, which in many ways is nothing. I mean, that's the way I see it.
No, I agree.
Could be on social issues, maybe. But even there, you look at the Democrats say on abortion rights, it becomes a bargaining chip.
Right.
And they can't even say the words abortion rights. It's the right to life versus the right to choose. I mean, do women have the right to control their own bodies? Yes or no? And the Democrats just won't present it like that because, again, they keep moving steadily to the right, or they are the right.
Mm-hmm.
And thus, they provide the electorate with very few alternatives. And thus, the electorate is not excited. And thus, the electorate that might vote against the Republicans stay home. and thus the Republicans might win, which is exactly what happened in 2016.
Right. And it's exactly what's going to happen in 2020. I cannot see the 2020 national election not following the very same path that it did in 2016, because we can't rely on a Democratic Party that won't stand up to something as simple as we shouldn't bomb a sovereign nation based on a lie. I mean, they went for it in Iraq. They didn't stand up against it in Iraq.
And the other argument that I think is important to make is that this bombing attack happened the day before the weapons inspectors got there.
Now, absolutely.
Even if the weapons inspectors found that the Assad government, for some ridiculous reason, used chemical weapons, the one weapon that would trigger foreign intervention at the moment that the government had actually won the war, even let's assume that without conceding it, it still wouldn't be a legal attack because right. member states of the United Nations don't have the right to decide to attack another nation. Like, I don't think we would accept the idea that if, say, Iran didn't like U.S. policy, you know, and by the way, U.S. did sort of meddle in Iranian politics once upon a time.
A wee bit.
Oh, yeah, it overthrew the democratically elected government in 1953.
A tiny bit. A little bit of meddling there.
Yeah, I mean, it's just not acceptable that the U.S. or Britain or France can do this. Again, these are the real issues. And as you both said, and as, you know, we were talking because we were all out in the streets this weekend, 50th anniversary of the Poor People's March, and on the eve of what would have been the Poor People's March, and after the 50th anniversary of the killing of Dr. King, where Dr. King said, you know, the bombs bursting, the bombs dropped in Southeast Asia are bursting in the inner cities of America, meaning
That's right.
you can't have war abroad for empire and have a war on poverty at home.
That's
These
right.
are still the issues.
Yeah.
Exactly. And we can't trust a Democratic Party that will not stand up for those values. None of them. If they won't oppose an illegal war or an illegal military action, we cannot expect these people to oppose illegal police actions, like something that we saw, like you said, Walter, in Philadelphia, where two black men are subjected to arrest by the police after walking into a Starbucks store 2 minutes. It was actually 2 minutes after they arrived. Six police officers show up and they're arrested literally just because they made the manager uncomfortable. We're never going to solve those kinds of social issues if our politicians don't recognize the sovereignty of other nations and the value of other people's lives around the world. We don't have democratic politicians who will stand up for those very basic rights of all human beings. And they continue to support war abroad that takes away resources from addressing those issues on issues that we're on fights that we are engaging in domestically. And it's all connected. And it is so frustrating that the politicians who are supposed to be the good guys, the Democrats, don't make those arguments at all. And they go further to marginalize activists who do make those connections.
Yeah, and what I'm really concerned about is taking this what's happening in the Middle East region and expanding it to such a dangerous level. And I'm talking about Iran. We know that Israel just bombed Iranian positions in Syria, right? Now the Iranians promised some retaliation for that. Now the Iranians are saying because Trump is still trying to get out of this deal with Iran. And Iran said that they had several ways of retaliating if the United States do that. Now, I don't know what those seven ways are. But again, this is backing Iran in a corner, unnecessarily so, and potentially basically just pouring more gasoline on an already incendiary situation.
And since you brought up Israel, I mean, we should mention the protests that are happening today. I'm just looking now. As we're recording this interview, three are dead. Al Jazeera is reporting 445 wounded. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no country in the world. Like, imagine if this happened in one of the countries that the United States is, you know, designated as one of the enemy countries. I mean, it would be 24/7 news coverage, you know, all day. There'd be calls for, you know, there would be calls for intervention. Somebody right. has to do something. But, you know, for Israel, for an ally, an important ally of the United States, and in fact, you know, a proxy in a lot of ways for their interests in the region, none of that matters. Nobody even notices, it seems like.
Yeah, and there hasn't even been, at least I haven't been aware of any, there hasn't even been a special UN council meeting behind this. It seems like you just said, it seems like it's just being just swept under the rug. Since they had the peaceful protests a week ago, or maybe about a week ago, over 2,000 Palestinians have been shot. I mean, over 2,000. And I think something like almost 200 have been seriously injured, and maybe like 100 killed. That's an enormous amount of people for a population, basically unarmed population, basically a population who poses no military threat to Israel. And yet every time the Israeli, the IDF, commit these type of atrocities, the only thing, and it's funny that Brian said, talked about Dr. King's talking about war here in the United States, because all the Israelis have to do is mention that our security is threatened, or it's in our security. And here we have in the United States two high profile shootings of unarmed black men in the progressive state of California, right? And the same thing with the police. Oh, our lives were threatened. You know, I mean, it's like you still see, you know, so it just boggles my mind.
Yeah, it's an immunity. It's right. Like it's if we, the police officers, feel our lives were threatened, even if the person's running away.
Right.
All you have to do is affirm. You have to say those words. I felt my life was in danger. That is legal justification. All Israel has to do when confronted with peaceful protesters or a peaceful protest movement like boycott, divest, sanctions, all they have to do is say, this scares us.
Exactly.
And then everything starts to happen. You can shoot people, unarmed people. I mean, when you shoot, you know, more than 1,000 people on 2 or 3 days, no other government is doing this. I don't right. believe.
No.
I mean, this would be, I mean, it's a good thing it wasn't North Korea shooting, you know, 2,000 peaceful protesters. But nobody, you know, nobody else does this. And yet it's just like a ho-hum attitude by the media. And again, both parties, Democrats and Republicans, even the most liberal wing of the Democratic Party, no different on this question.
Exactly. And this is the problem when we're talking about real issues that impact real people's everyday lives. And we have politicians, well, we have millionaires like Tom Steyer, who is now backing Feinstein's challenger in California, Kevin DeLeon. And when we were on a few weeks ago, we talked about how nobody in California knew who Kevin DeLeon was because he didn't have any money for ads to go up against Feinstein. Well, now Steyer's backing him, and Steyer's this millionaire who they're hoping now can get other outside contributions to help DeLeon with a campaign to get his name out. Well, that's all fine and good in getting rid of the quote unquote establishment Dianne Feinstein. But when you are a voter of color, when you are a Palestinian American, when you are an Israeli citizen, or when you're a Jewish person who does not like the oppression of the Israeli government, and you want your politician to be accountable for their allegiances with police states like Israel, and you want to find out, hey, is our police department being sent to Israel to be trained by the IDF? If these politicians aren't making these connections for the voters, then how do voters win? How are the kinds of politicians that millionaires are backing any different or any better than the ones they're challenging?
Let's talk about some of the things that are happening that could have an impact, of course, on the midterm elections. But again, as we're talking about, even more importantly than the midterm elections, on policy and politics in America, and that is this wave of teacher strikes.
Right.
We had West Virginia. They stayed out for 6 days wildcatting, which means without union authorization because it's not a legal strike. Protests in Kentucky, the walkout in Oklahoma. Now Arizona teachers have said they're going to strike starting next Thursday. There's a lot of indications that these grassroots uprisings by unionists who happen to be also school teachers and thus connected to communities and thus connected to students and parents and families, they're reshaping politics in red states. Talk about that.
Yes. More people are becoming aware of how politics as usual are really not helping them. They're not working for them. They're seeing more people in red states are seeing in their own lives the struggle that a lot of people in urban areas and people of color have been struggling against for years. Now, because the politics have been so bad consistently across the aisle for most Americans, now everybody's feeling that pain. So this grassroots movement against what we keep calling establishment politics, this populist wave of politics is growing on the right and on the left because Americans are hurting across the board now. And the American dream that used to be advertised to middle white America, it's crumbling. People are waking up to the nightmare that all of it was just a facade and corporations own their politicians and dictate their politics. And people are fighting back against that. And we're seeing that manifest itself in these teacher strikes, where even if they belong to unions, politicians aren't listening to the unions anymore because they're listening to the corporate interests. And teachers, union members have no protections for decent wages and decent benefits. So they're adopting the tactics from, you know, previous generations of protesters, of leftists. Activists of taking to the streets and staging wildcat strikes to demand that their voices are being heard. And this is the way middle America is beginning to, like you said, Brian, reshape American politics.
Yeah. And I think that that the Democrats, this definitely would benefit the Democratic Party because a lot of these strikes are taking place in, as you said, red states that are being run by Republicans. So the Republicans can't really gain from these strikes. And I think that if the Democrats play their cards right and not let some of these establishment Democrats come and co-opt it, as they have done in the past when it comes to these union movements. Oh, yeah, we're with you until the union support them. And then they, you know, they have these anti-union policies. So I think that the Democrats can be on the right side of history here if they play it right.
Yeah. And again, let's think about just the human dynamic about change, because change comes not just when people move, but also when people change. And sometimes people don't change until they start moving. Like right. Sometimes consciousness, not sometimes, I think mainly consciousness comes as a consequence of people's reality having shifted by their own entrance into struggle.
Mm-hmm.
So you have teachers, some of whom voted for Trump, some of whom voted for Clinton, some of them voted for Jill Stein,
mm-hmm.
some of them for Gloria LaRiva, in other words, a socialist candidate, but mainly Democrats, mainly Republicans. And these are red states that we're talking about. So those states were carried by Trump. Now, when you go out on strike and the strike is not legal, you find out that all the editorial writers are going to be more or less against you. You find out that the police are going to be basically against you. You're going to find out the courts are basically against you. You're going to find out that the Republican Party, even if you voted for it, is against you. All sorts of things start to become clear as a consequence of struggle. Like Frederick Douglass said, you know, without struggle, there can't be progress. And if we believe in human beings and believe in human beings as the movers and shakers of history, we have to recognize that human beings change because of their own intervention, participation in struggle. And that's what's so promising, I think, about these red state strikes right now, because regardless of whether somebody voted for Hillary Clinton or Trump, two elite multi-millionaire, Trump pretending to be a billionaire politician, regardless of the fact that they function at the polls as a tail to those kites, they're now making their own history. They're now shaping or trying to shape their own history.
I agree. And I think where the whole Trump phenomena plays into this is people who may not have been as politically engaged before, they are also seeing how much more they're having to struggle under policy that they've supported, whether under Republican, but especially in the red states, under Republican policies, they're still having to struggle. But they're seeing how the president they voted for is not honest. And again, going back to Syria, that's a prime example. Here's a guy who campaigned on not getting involved in other countries' affairs and pulling troops out of Syria and Afghanistan. And even in saying to voters, when we're looking at domestic issues like the tax bill, he actually said in one rally that, you know, after we overhaul the tax system, you're going to be so rich it's ridiculous. Well, people are seeing that none of that has happened. None of it is true. And people are angry.
And also Trump learning, as we mentioned before, if the 26 major newspapers all support him when he bombs Syria, then he can just keep bombing Syria.
Right.
So for his own base, who believed him or wanted to believe him that the U.S. was not going to be engaged in endless war and regime change, that too, sort of the sand comes out of people's eyes.
Exactly.
Right. And again, it's that people just see that it's just politics as usual. It's just everything else as usual. No matter about what Trump's promises, draining swamps and making all these changes, it's still the same thing.
Yeah. And then at the end of the day, for people like the teachers who are on strike, it's following the money. If our politicians at the highest levels are lying to us and doing all of this stuff that they said they wouldn't do, that they said they wouldn't do so that they could give us a better life, how are their lies impacting our everyday lives? And they're seeing it.
Yeah, people are definitely starting to see it. And there needs to be independent political organizations, because vague consciousness or a passive consciousness doesn't do it. We have 30 seconds left on this. People have to be connected to something that's real, that they can work with their friends, their families, their people in their community, to actually do the kinds of things that need to happen in order to make change.
Yeah, I agree. I think that if we're going to get any real change, it has to start from the grassroots. You know, and I'm really encouraged by this guy down in Texas, the socialist who wants to get into the race. And I think that we need more of this type of outside the box type thinking.
Well, unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it right there. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Before we go to break, Jacqueline, tell us how our listeners can learn about the Lukman Nation.
You can find Lukman Nation on YouTube and on Facebook. Just search for us under Lukman Nation, LUKMANNATION.
All right, we'll be right back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.